Hello and welcome to the Echo Chamber Podcast. My name is Tony Groves and today we are going across the Atlantic. Martin, have you ever been allowed out or would they let you in?
They will let me into New York. I'm not so sure because I trolled Donald for so long that maybe immigration would be waiting for me when I got there, but maybe.
You did get thrown off Twitter for a week for sending Donald Trump a trolling tweet, didn't you?
I did. That time where he was unexplainedly in a hospital for a while and he got out and he was ranting on Twitter. And I just said, relax, you'll have another stroke. And that got me kicked off for a week.
Yeah, well, look, I wouldn't say you're without your problems. Anyway, look, guys, bit of housekeeping. As you know, the Tortoise Shack relies on listeners. We rely on your support. We do need people to go to patreon.com/tortoiseshack. Price of a cup of coffee really helps us keep this show on the road. Anyway, enough of that. And much more importantly, we are delighted to be joined via Zoom by John Schwartz of TheIntercept.com. John, thank you so much for taking our call. I really appreciate this.
Well, I really appreciate the invitation. You know, one of the best things about this terrible, terrible time is like just everybody being able to talk all over the world about this stuff. So I really look forward to it.
Well, I'm going to go jump straight in because when I kind of reached out to you, it was because you had early doors in this global pandemic. You had written a really good article that had pointed out that, you know, the stock market was already a bubble in effect in many ways, the whether we call it a Trump bubble or whatever the situation was. And we were already looking into the depths of what COVID could be in terms of a global recession. Do you want to just explain a little bit about the logic behind that article?
Yeah, like I don't know what it's like there. What I know is America, and in America, you cannot escape everybody on the news, all politicians yammering all day long every day about the stock market. Like the stock market is the most important thing on earth, and that's crazy for a bunch of different reasons. One of the reasons is that, like, the stock market was way, way overvalued before the impact of this new coronavirus. It is, in fact, the U.S. stock market, at least, is still overvalued. The traditional way that people measure it is something called the price-to-earnings ratio. And historically, that's the average has been about 15. And before it started falling here in the U.S., it was over 30, meaning that it was more than twice the historical average. Now I think it's something like 24, maybe. So it's still high. But the fact is that what that is a financial bubble. And financial bubbles feel great to a lot of people on the way up. You guys may have experience with that yourselves, I understand.
Yes, very much so.
Yeah. And so everybody thinks they're getting rich. It has nothing to do with reality. Like, humans have done this over and over and over and over again throughout history. You know, most recently with the housing bubble. So it feels great. People think they're getting rich without working, and then it crashes and it feels much worse than it ever felt good. And so that was the situation that we were in before the impact of the coronavirus. And it's very dangerous, as we now know, to get caught up in these weird delusions about financial bubbles in general, and the stock market in particular. The stock market is not a measure of human health or happiness or even like basic human wealth. Like in the United States, 80% of the stock is owned by the richest 10% of U.S. households. So it's kind of irrelevant for most people in terms of their own money. It's not irrelevant in other terms, which is like the stock market is theoretically a measurement of future, like, post-tax corporate profits. Like, that's at its core, that's what it is. And it's just a fact that the more corporations profit, the less money there is left over for the people who work there. And so if everybody thinks that, like, corporate profits are going to be super high in the future, what that means is that they also just logically believe that working people are going to have less money or are going to be paid less. So it's generally irrelevant. When it is relevant to normal people, the success of the stock market is bad.
And when you, and again, you're quite right to point out, we had a huge bubble here, and it was heavily weighted in terms of property, be it both residential and business, but where commercial. But where we've really struggled now is we're seeing, obviously, the our economy. They keep saying the phrases, it's been put to sleep. You know, we're trying to put the economy to sleep, and then the hope that, you know, that it won't atrophy enough that we, when we re-wake it after this. However, what we've seen is the huge stimulus that's happened now in the US is still kind of keeping the market in a false economy. Is that a fair comment?
Yeah, I mean, this is very much like the bailout of Wall Street in 2008 in the United States. You know, what happened at the end of, it was September in 2008, just before the presidential election that November. Mm. And Wall Street was totally falling apart. And Hank Paulson, who was George Bush's Secretary of the Treasury at the time, went to Congress basically with a page of paper that said, give us $700 billion. Like that seems like a joke, but it really isn't. Like, that's pretty much all it said. Like, give us $700 billion and we'll do whatever we want with it. And it was changed somewhat because Congress voted it down the first time. But the same attitude carried over to now. It's just the most powerful corporations, the most powerful people in America see this as a fantastic opportunity to open the U.S. Treasury and take out everything inside. Mm. And that's exactly what they're doing. Like, you would like to believe that the government of the United States cared at least a little bit about regular people. I think they care about us to the degree that they would like us to, like, keep buying stuff, but that's pretty much it. Like the stimulus package now is very much focused on large corporations, giving them as much money as possible. And there's a little bit left over for everybody else. So that's how it's happening here. Like, I'd be curious to know, like, what the situation is like there, if you're having the same problems, because we'd like to know that like somebody somewhere is having an easier time of it.
We would be quite critical. We'd be quite critical of our government in terms of how, you know, did they act fast enough? Did they close the borders quickly enough? Did they close the schools quickly enough? Did, you know, all of these things that they could have done. And the main rebuttal by anybody, and I mean this, the main rebuttal you get from anybody is, well, at least it's not Trump.
All right. That does make us feel a little bit better that, you know, that we could theoretically improve.
Yeah.
Well, that said, our parliament here has been effectively put to sleep for 2 weeks at a period when huge decisions, money decisions, are being made. And we've seen that reflected in questions about how they've taken the private hospitals, how they're renting the private hospitals rather than nationalizing the private hospitals. We've also seen it in our homeless services, that the NGOs have been locked out of the room, and that it's now corporatized, and that it is corporate figures who are now taking care of the homeless. People who never were involved in homeless services before are suddenly putting security cards on doors to hostels and the such like that. So we have an intent out of tent experience going on, where those within the know are probably doing quite well, and everybody else is locked outside the tent, and no political oversight, which is worrying.
We did describe it as looters in suits making large profits. You know, we do often refer to Goldman Sachs and pillages on this podcast, and there is an element of that. Just what we aren't doing, though, and what is, I don't know if it's unique to the United States, but there's certainly an issue right now, as far as I'm aware, and you may comment on this, John, around states bidding against each other for respirators and ventilators.
It is the most incredible thing. Like, as low an opinion as I had of the US government before this, it really is something that I would have never believed possible. I mean, it's like total madness, and yet it's true. I mean, I know that for myself and for my family and people that I care about, like, we've had very serious discussions about the reality that the government absolutely does not care whether we live or die, and we're on our own. And so everybody has to make calculations with that in mind. Yeah, no, it's crazy. And I get up every morning and I can't believe it's true, but it is.
Can I ask, in terms of, I know you know people can follow your Twitter account at Schwartz as Ed, but if you listen to, if you even follow on your Twitter feed, you will see the, you often comment on the reaction of the right, which is very much, let's get business back up and running. And the callousness of that, is there a huge demand for that in the US at the moment, given the really dreadful state of things?
I would say that there's not a huge demand for that from regular people, but there's, you know, again, we have to kind of accept that regular people make no difference whatsoever when the powerful people are making decisions. And so the very powerful people do want to reopen the economy. They're not the ones who are going to end up dying. And so to them, like, it's all upside. Why not? Let's do it. And so I believe that if we do reopen the economy in some way, it's inevitably going to be a catastrophe, and it's just going to have to be shut down again pretty soon, because, you know, again, like, the people in charge are both criminals and completely incompetent. And so there's no way that, you know, like, with a functional government, like, maybe there would be a way to do it fairly quickly. Like, I don't know, really, nobody knows. But what we do know is that with this government, there's no way on earth it could possibly work.
Here's the big thing, and I say this as external observations of the US. Our big fear is genuinely that now with Biden the nominee, and even with Bernie's endorsement, it's terrifying to think that if Trump is as bad as he is, and he is terrible, I would echo the sentiments that he is terrible. He is criminal, and he's worse than we imagined. He will be even worse if he gets a second term.
Yes, you are correct about that. You are correct, number one, that he could be reelected, and you're correct to be terrified about that possibility. And I'm also sorry to say, like back in, March or April of 2016, I remember saying on Twitter that, like, you know, people should not be confident that the Democrats cannot lose to Trump. Mm. Like, the Democrats could lose to a turnip.
Yeah, that is so true.
Yeah, I mean, it's really an incredible, like, you've got to respect it. Like, they have an incredible skill. They put in an enormous amount of work, and they do things that no one would ever imagine possible. And so I think Biden is going to win. I think that things are going to get so bad for regular people that it's going to be very difficult for Trump to hang on. But as we know, like, nothing makes any sense on earth now, and anything is possible. So, I think that Biden will win, but I would not bet money on it.
Well, in a world where anything is possible, and that's exactly where we are now, is that anything is possible. We, over here in Ireland, we're seeing people in very expensive cars sitting in queues to go and get food.
Right.
And I'm wondering how long society can take that before there is some backlash, before there is some... I suppose, impetus to push back. Are you seeing any signs of that yet in the US?
I do think that everyone on earth is kind of losing their minds. And particularly if there are real issues with people who used to have some power in their lives, who used to be fairly affluent, like needing to go to food banks, like that is going to cause some really seismic political changes. And I wrote something about how inevitably there's going to be this wave of incredible anger in the United States, and that it's going to be organized either from a progressive perspective from the left, or it's going to be organized from the right. And for it to be organized from the right is extremely dangerous. Like, it's dangerous here, it's dangerous all over the world. To me, it's particularly dangerous because I live here, but also because the United States has so much influence. Like, if the right can do it here, the right all over the world is going to be totally emboldened.
just you've referenced that article, and it is, I think it's the Democratic Party must harness the legitimate rage of Americans, otherwise the right will use it. And in that, you do go back to an earlier election, post depression, and a Democratic presidential candidate using the phrase "fighting mad." Do you want to explain what that was about?
Yeah, I mean, I just kind of imagined two possible futures for America, like one where the left organizes the anger and one where the right does it. And one of the weird things of the Democratic Party, I don't know if it comes across all the way across the ocean, but the people who run the Democratic Party are mostly like kind of like professorial lawyers and or corporate managers, and they're really uncomfortable with emotion in general, and they think it's kind of illegitimate to use emotion in politics. And so Obama, you know, was like super, super emotionally cool, right?
Yeah.
Like never got upset about anything. And so he was extremely attractive to sort of that class of Democrats, like the people who run the party. And it was all about being a technocrat and all about being rational. Well, like, that doesn't work when everybody's grandmother has just been killed by the coronavirus and the president of the United States and everybody else with any amount of power in the United States in America has just been, as I say, like opening the treasury and helping themselves to everything inside. Like that's not going to be a successful brand of politics. And so what I imagined was a Democratic candidate, like, who would use that as a motto, fighting mad. Like, you should be both mad and you should be willing to fight against the people who are doing this to us. And in my dream, this will never happen, but in my dreams, a Democratic candidate would give themselves and normal people the permission to be angry. I think people who are scared of anger do not understand something which is very profound, which is that the word anger is derived from an old Norse word that means sorrow. You know, that is where anger comes from. It comes from very deep sorrow. And people need to address, politicians need to address, like, the very real sorrow that Americans are going to be feeling. And if they don't, then the right is going to take control of it, and it's going to be a catastrophe. You know, I mentioned how in The Grapes of Wrath, it describes the anger of people and how people were both simultaneously, they were angry at the crime that was being committed, like sort of against them and the world, and they were also angry at the people who were suffering from the crime. And human beings are weird, like they're psychologically strange, and they can hold both of those things in their heads at the same time. And you need people to accentuate the anger at the crime, not the anger at the victims. And that's what the right is going to try to do. Like, they're already trying to do it, and if they succeed, it is going to be a disaster.
How long do you think America has to get its act together under lockdown conditions? We've seen now other countries have extended out a month and longer, and the talk now is that this rolling lockdowns may exist for well in excess of a year, maybe longer. What's the chance of the political vista in America surviving something that goes on that long?
Well, I can imagine it being okay. Like, again, if the people in charge had brains larger than a walnut. But unfortunately, that's the situation that we're in here. Like, it would be tough under the best conditions. Like, under these conditions, God only knows. I mean, it's really.
Do you think societal breakdown is a very real possibility in the U.S.?
It is, in some sense. Like, it's very difficult to know. Like it's going to be very difficult to tell the degree to which society is breaking down, because first of all the reporters are locked up in their homes, like ourselves. Secondly, because American media institutions were on the edge of collapsing before now, and now they're in desperate straits.
Yeah.
And third, American media institutions have always been oriented towards like the richest 20 or 25% of America. And so, like, American society has already been breaking down for many decades. And
yeah,
it was hard to tell, like, if you're just watching TV, because they don't care. Like, they don't pay any attention to the bottom 75% of Americans. So I guarantee you that things are worse for a lot of people than you know if you're just paying attention to the American media.
Yeah, we are hearing, and actually in the UK as well, I don't know if you know John Harris from The Guardian, but we've had John on the show a couple of times, and he wrote a really powerful piece recently about, you know, that unfortunately there are going to be people discovered in their apartments or their flats or whatever terminology you want to have, who have passed from this virus, who are undiscovered because of the atomization of society in many ways, and how those inequalities that have been coming for decades now have resulted in some of this breakdown in these social connections. We're obviously very hopeful in this pod. We tend to try and say, you know, what we can learn from these things, how we can come back from them. And, you know, in terms of, say, for Ireland, for example, as Martin pointed out, we took control of the private hospitals. Now we are paying rent for them, but I don't know how you tell an electorate post COVID that we're going to give them back to you know, and we're going to go back to a way that if you have money, you get it, and if you don't, you don't. So it's very hard to unsee some of these things, and we're kind of hoping that the kind of no going back movement will rise in Ireland. However, I look at the US, and if we'd seen the, you know, they talk about, you know, AOC and the power that was coming from the left, and yet socialism is still a dirty word somewhat, yeah?
It's not just socialism that's a dirty word. Like, even like liberal is a dirty word in America. I mean, I think you're right that there is like a huge potential here. Like, that this is going to change people's consciousnesses in a way that nothing else has in our lifetimes.
Hmm.
And I would also say that please, 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 like, make that happen in Ireland, because I'm not kidding. I say, like, that would really help us a lot. Like, the world it really is connected in a way now. And like, success like that there would be a big help to us. So please seize the opportunity, and we'll do our best here, but you guys may be better position than we are.
I think you're right there, and I think the countries who tackle this best, and I mean best from a social point of view, not best from an economic point of view, I think they are going to be the countries that will come back up faster. I think you can protect your economy and your society is still going to be locked down. I think if you protect your society, you can at least have a view of opening up your economy again. And again, the economy is not set in stone. It changes. It adapts to the situation. The idea that the economy has to be saved, the economy that exists at this particular moment in history needs to be saved, is kind of a bit of a nonsense. You don't really need to save what exists at the moment. You need to adapt what's there to save people.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I very much hope that, everybody in Ireland with that perspective can successfully make that case. And we're going to be trying here. We'll be doing our best, but it really will be like, it really will make a difference for Americans if people elsewhere are able to make this happen. So I salute you for real and hope you can do that.
We keep hearing that despite the fact that we would, I suppose we would call our leading party the last few years was we would call it a center-right party, or they would describe themselves maybe as center-right, and we would be very definitely trying to drag them towards the left and move that Overton window back. And I think that this COVID pandemic has the potential to do that, and we're seeing it already in policy documents that are coming out. And I've also listened to many commentators in the US who would describe themselves as sort of center-left, describe Joe Biden's platform as the most progressive in the history of any American candidate. Would you have a similar view of that?
I don't know, maybe. Like, political platforms from the Democratic Party have no meaning whatsoever.
You know? Perfectly put.
Like, I mean, maybe that's true. On the other hand, who cares? Like, I don't know what it's like in the rest of the world. And that's not how politics gets done here. Like, that's a document to get people enthusiastic about something that's never going to happen.
Mm. Have I heard that helicopter money is on the cards for the U.S.?
Probably not. Just because, you know, that would involve, like, generally speaking, when people talk about helicopter money, that means, you know, everybody getting the same amount. And that's not how it works here. Like, you got to give the big corporations most of it first. And then if there's a little bit left over, then maybe if other people can get some. But I certainly endorse that. I mean, one of the things that people hopefully are learning right now is the degree to which, like, money is not real. Like,
yes,
like it's a made up thing, and governments don't need to like tax people to get money. You guys have probably spoken to people who talk about modern monetary theory, right?
Yeah. I keep making the point to Martin over and over as someone who made his career come out of financial institutions. What do I always say, Martin? The debt never gets repaid, and the money
gets restructured.
and the numbers on the computer screen just grow larger and larger.
That's exactly right. You guys. I don't know if you've ever spoken to the Canadian writer John Ralston Saul.
No, but I'll write it down now.
You write down his name. He is one of the smartest and most interesting people on earth, at least to me. And you know, decades ago he was talking about how it's like, you know, hopefully people can open up their minds and realize that money is just pieces of paper or electrons, and it doesn't have any real basis in physical reality. Like, there is such a thing as inflation. Like, there are limits on the amount of money that governments can print, but that is the very last thing that we have to worry about. Like, literally of the top 10,000 problems in America right now, that is the 10,000th. So, again, I hope that that's something that people can understand. Like, all of a sudden, the rules have changed when rich people are in trouble, and it turns out you can just print as much money as you need, and that's something to keep in mind in the future.
We did see that during the financial crisis, that, you know, when rich people need a bailout, it's there. It's there, no questions asked.
As one of our other contributors to the podcast, Rory Hearn, the lecturer, has often said, austerity is he defines it as socialism for rich people.
Yes, that's exactly right.
John, last thing for me in terms of we can talk about civil unrest and the potential for it, but do you feel like within the confines of the American political system that this is inevitably going to be like, how do they even have an election in the context of Corona and these things? How do these things happen? Is there contingencies, or should we be worried as people from across the Atlantic looking at the U.S. for American democracy?
You should be extremely worried, is my answer. In theory, we could easily have an election even in the midst of a continuing pandemic in November. Like, we could have universal vote by mail.
Hmm.
What we can see is Donald Trump, you know, like, God bless Donald Trump, who really is, I wrote something else once about how he is simultaneously the most dishonest president in American history and also the most honest, where, like, he'll blurt out things that all the rest of them know not to say. And so, recently he said, look, the Democrats want this universal vote by mail. And, you know, if we had that, like, no Republican would ever be elected again.
But that, I remember hearing him say that. And you're dead right about that character of his. He has this character where everything is cloaked, but within it, there are nuggets of real truth that you won't hear from any other politician.
The Ukraine phone call, that was a perfect phone call. It was a perfect call. I just told him, I'm not giving him the money, but if he doesn't do it, it was a perfect, and I didn't use any. I was like, what are you talking about? This man is mad.
It is wonderful in its own way when he's like talking about America's wars in the Mideast. He's like, I don't understand why we're not just taking the oil.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's the same when it came to, you know, the meddling again in Afghanistan and going back in, and you see the reemergence of, like, oh, he's, Eric Prince is back on good terms with him. You're going, what is this world that we're living in? And we do complain a lot about our government over here, and trust me, no one complains more than me and Mark.
Yeah, we do.
But we look across, and we should get a T-shirt that says at least he's not Trump. You know.
It is incredible that the world's standard on dealing with the virus, that the lowest standard is set by Trump. Everybody has to be better than Trump. I mean, that really is, it's a shocking indictment of probably, you know, the biggest economy, the land of the free. It's a shocking indictment.
Yeah, it is, for real. And, you know, someone British actually told me this. Someone British who'd lived in the United States for a long time said that, you know, one of the reasons politics is so weird in America is that Americans genuinely have no idea what's going on in the rest of the world, and that anyone is doing better than America. And this person told me that for Americans, the way we look at the rest of the world, Americans look at the world, is pretty much the way that everybody else on Earth looks at the solar system. In the sense that, like, you learn about it in third grade, and then you really don't think about it for the rest of your life. Hmm. So we know you guys are out there somewhere, just like Mars is, but it doesn't have any impact on our day-to-day lives.
Yeah, I think in Ireland, after a decade or so of post-global financial crisis, we have gone from the point where we spent 100 years sort of saying, well, we were closer to Boston then Berlin, and, you know, these phrases were used, and now we're thinking, actually, we're kind of closer to the Mediterranean culture in who we want to be and what a kind of how we want to center our economy. And I think we're dragging that there, and we're hoping that, again, we want to be optimistic and say no going back. We're sticking to that, Martin. No matter, I'm looking at his face, and he's not as positive as I am, but we're trying to stick to it. I do think we will end up with a more positive outlook in Ireland. I'm hopeful that Joe Biden will actually win, and hopefully that he will win only because he's dragged there by the more left-wing elements of the Democratic Party. I don't know if that's just me being hopelessly optimistic, but I really appreciate you taking the time, John. It really means a lot to us, and we will hope that you know people will check out your work. It's on theintercept.com. You're available on Twitter at SCHWARZ, so make sure you check it out, and thanks so much for your time.
Yeah, well, thank you for your time. I very much hope you guys stay safe and well, and your family does too. This is really, really an awful event that everyone is going to remember for the rest of their lives, but there are great things about it too, and getting the opportunity to talk like this is one of them.
Thank you very much for talking to us, Jonathan.
Thanks for listening, folks. Again, we do need your support. If you could head over to patreon.com/tortoiseshack. Martin is sitting in his house coat, and yep, Lord knows we need some turtle wax for that head of his. talk to you all soon. Take care. Bye-bye.